Morning. Welcome to the second week of cosmology course. So last week we discussed the FRW space-time, so geometry describing our universe. And we discussed some kinematic effects which follow from this geometry, such as the existence of horizons and stuff like that. So now in this week, I would like to tell you about thermal history of the universe. And so we will discuss various matter components which appear in the universe and you know how they come to be and so on. So a necessary technical tool to do that is actually this tool of thermodynamics in expanding universe. And so we will simplify our life. So of course, because the universe is expanding, we don't really have equilibrium. And so that means that if you want to calculate statistical quantities using the distribution function, this distribution function is a solution of some complicated, let's say, Boltzmann equation or any other kinetic equation which is appropriate for your description. And you know that makes things quite complicated and they have to be solved by computer. And so we will avoid all that trouble and we will get qualitatively right results just doing equilibrium thermodynamics if you want. And so you'll be using this criterion for local thermal equilibrium, which says that basically the reaction rate for my reaction which is going on and which is just trying to establish the equilibrium is much, much bigger than the rate given by the Hubble scale. And so that means really if I'm colliding the particles, there is many, many collisions of these particles before the universe significantly expands. And because there is many, many collisions, you can sort of assume that there is something like an equilibrium at that point. Okay, so now if you have this thermal equilibrium, you can just use the standard equilibrium thermodynamics. So from here, you know that the distribution function is just given by Bose-Einstein or their distributions, E minus the chemical potential temperature, and then minus for bosons or plus for fermions, 1. And so using this thing here, you can calculate now all the quantities which you want. So you can calculate the particle density as an integral E3P over 2 pi 3 of F. And similarly, you can calculate the density and you can calculate the pressure, which is basically the quantities which we are after. So the same way you would calculate exactly, but you would just be plugging different F if you want non-equilibrium processes there. Okay, and so now these formulas are quite complicated even in this simple case. And so for us, it's again enough to consider just two cases. And so case A was the relativistic limit when the temperature is much bigger than the mass of the particle and the chemical potential. And then, so basically the temperature is the only quantity which has units of energy. In our units, h bar equals to c equals to 1 or whatever. So it's the only temperature which basically exists, and all the other quantities like mass and mu you just set equal to 0. And then it's not surprising that just by dimensional analysis, you find that n is proportional to t cubed, and then rho is proportional to t to the 4, and p is proportional to t to the 4 as well. Okay. So now there are some concrete numbers standing in this formula in front of t cube and t4 and so on. And you will calculate those in your homework, and maybe you already did. But I'll give you one good hint. So what you should find is that if you calculate the equation of state, you should find 1 over 3. So interestingly, these factors which stand in front of t cube and t4, they are different for fermions and bosons. But this is true for both of them. Okay, so you are getting that something which is familiar from electromagnetic theory, for example. Okay, the case B was the non-relativistic case, non-relativistic limit. So now I say that the temperature is actually small. and then mu is smaller than m. And so what we have seen, and there is some dirty calculation which doesn't make much sense, but anyway, the result is interesting, is that the particle density is just proportional to E to minus the mass over the temperature. And I haven't done, but maybe you did already at, in your homework, is that the density is simply just the mass of the particle times the particle times the number density, and the pressure is something like, well, it's probably equal, just equal, both of them. So this is what you should find in the case of non-relativistic particles. And again, if I calculate the equation of state, P over rho, well, then you see that from these formulas, it's just P over m. But of course, I'm treating T much smaller than m in our approximation. So that means that this is approximately equal to zero. And so we derive that really for non-relativistic particles, they have sort of like zero pressure in between them. And so this exponential decay is the most interesting and important thing, telling you that the thermodynamics hates massive particles. So whenever the particle is massive and it is in thermodynamic equilibrium or thermal equilibrium, it basically doesn't exist because it exponentially decays. So that would mean that if we actually were to maintain thermal equilibrium throughout the history of the universe, there wouldn't be any massive particles. They would all decay to zero. And so at some point, what must happen is actually that the equilibrium is not a good description anymore. And so the particles sort of decouple from equilibrium. And then we can observe them. Then they survive. And then, you know, the particle number since then is conserved. And we can observe them. So, but it's only possible if they decouple from equilibrium. They stay in equilibrium. They just exponentially decay to zero. OK. Questions? No questions. So now, adiabatic expansion. Adiabatic expansion of universe. So now, interestingly, throughout the interesting periods of the history of the universe, you can treat that, of course, the universe is expanding, but you can treat this expansion as adiabatic, meaning that the entropy doesn't change. So during thermal evolution, of universe, entropy is conserved. Okay, so of course this is an approximation, which however is more or less true. And so the reason for that is, so if you have the equilibrium processes, so you know, so if you have equilibrium process, then there is no production of entropy basically, usually. So in equilibrium this is obvious. In equilibrium this is certainly true. So now if you have non-equilibrium processes, so you know something is going only one way direction, and you know some, so in principle you can have entropy production. But we shall use the fact that actually all these productions of entropies are really negligible when you compare them to the total entropy in the universe. So now, where do you think the entropy of the universe is hiding? So any guesses? So what is the matter component which has the most entropy in our universe? Anybody?
Radiation?
Radiation?
Yeah.
Radiation, something else? Something which has a huge entropy? Exactly. So actually the biggest content in the universe of entropy is black holes. But we don't need black holes here. They don't really contribute to the discussion. So then the radiation is the most important thing. So you know that the whole universe is penetrated by this cosmic microwave background, and that has huge, huge entropy. Okay, so in non-equilibrium, we can have entropy production. But what you can show is that this delta S, which is really produced, and is non-equilibrium, is much, much smaller than S total, which for our purposes we can take as S of radiation. And the reason for this is that, for example, you have 10 to 9 times more photons than, you know, baryons and stuff like that, than baryons. So if there are, you know, if there is some entropy production, let's say I am doing something with the baryons, then really it doesn't matter. So because, you know, everything is governed by this number of photons, by this CMB, and any entropy production is sort of negligible with respect to this. Okay, but the black holes, actually they have even more entropy. But of course they're sort of like decoupled, they don't interact with something. Okay, so now what it means is that, of course, S, the total entropy is constant, and you can write it as entropy density times volume, and so this is constant, and so volume goes like a cube as the universe is expanding, so that means that S goes like a minus cube. The entropy density goes like that. Okay. So now, this is very important formula which you will be using basically the whole week to study various processes. Okay, so let me do an example when you are still relativistic. So let's imagine that we have a bath of relativistic species. So for example, in the early universe, you know, all the particles which you know were relativistic, so protons, neutrons, everything was relativistic because the universe was so hot that this will be a good approximation. And so, in some sense, because we are a relativistic regime, we are neglecting the chemical potentials and we are neglecting the masses. So the only thing which everything can depend on is just the temperature which survives. So then we have rho is a function of T, and pressure is a function of T, and the entropy density is also a function of T only, because everything else is, you know, doesn't contribute. So now you need to derive an interesting formula between the entropy and energy density and pressure and temperature. And so one way to do this is based on your homework, and that's the rigorous way, so let me do it. So homework one, you have shown, or you will show shortly, is that under this assumption that everything is relativistic and everything is only a function of temperature, you can show that dP over dT is just rho plus P over time, over temperature. So this is what you have shown. So now, this is true for constant entropy. Now you can use the Maxwell relation. So remember this magic square where we have Vt Ps, and then you can write sort of dP over dT at constant entropy will be, so I'm going this way, dP over dT must be dS over dV at constant pressure, dS over dV at constant pressure. But of course, because the pressure is function of temperature only, so this means that this is dS over dV at constant temperature as well. So now dS over dV, well, S is small s times V, and S is only a function of temperature, so this is simply just small s. And so we derive this very important relation, is that small s, the entropy density, is just given by rho plus p over T. And of course, you are in the relativistic regime, so rho goes like T to the 4, pressure goes like T to the 4, so we divide it by T, so this is proportional to T cubed. Okay? Which of course we already know, because S goes like A minus 3, so and A goes like 1 over T, so this is what we know. Well, this is the precise relation between the entropy density and the energy density and pressure. Okay, so this relation is very, very important. So let me do one more heuristic derivation of this, which again bases on the first law of thermodynamics. So, but I think maybe the derivation is more convincing. But anyway, so alternatively, you can write down the first law of thermodynamics is TdS minus PdV. And then for the energy, you just write rho times V. So we have D rho V equals to T D, and now S is small s times V minus PdV. And then you see that you have terms which are proportional to something which is dependent on temperature. So we have T rho and then V plus dV and rho, and then we have T dS V and then dS dV and then minus pdV. So now you can collect the terms which are proportional to dV. So dV, well, this is that term, and that term minus ds, and then plus p. And then you can put all the other terms on the right-hand side. So we will have vt ds, and then minus v d rho. But if you look at our assumption that all, you know, s, small s, and rho is a function of temperature only. So this is written as something dT. Okay. So now, of course, you see, well, this is an equality. But on the left-hand side, you have dV, which must be independent to what happens with dT. So actually, both sides have to vanish independently. Okay. In particular, it means that this guy has to be 0, which brings you again that S is rho plus P over T. Okay? So simply comes from the fact that in this limit, where everything is function of temperature only, all those quantities, really what happens with these quantities depending on the temperature and with what happens with the quantities depending on the volume, they are independent. And if they are independent, both sides vanishes and we have this nice relation here. Okay. However, you know, you may not trust me that this is the case, and that's why I did that derivation first, which I think there's not, you know, you can argue with that derivation, you can maybe argue with this one. But of course, this is nice and simple, and you don't need to do your homework. Okay. Questions? Okay. So we now know that the entropy density is proportional to T cubed. So now let me just give you really the precise formula, which will be used again and again. So you know how rho is exactly in terms of T cubed, T to the 4, and how P is exactly proportional to T to the 4. So now you take these numbers and combine that relation, and you find that S for bosons is 2 pi squared over 45 T cubed, and for fermions is smaller than that, is 7 over 8 as bosons if they have the same temperature and same degrees of freedom. So this is for, okay, if you want, this is for 1 degree of freedom. So let's say I have a boson, a scalar, and then this would be per degree of freedom of a fermion. So if you have electron, then there will be twice that. because it has 2 degrees of freedom. So now what you will play with is that really I can have a path of various things. I can have paths of where fermions and bosons are together, and there's lots of species in the path. Okay, so typically, we have a path of many species. And it may happen that not all of them are in thermal equilibrium. It may happen that some things already decouple from the other things. So for example, it will be a nice example when we have neutrinos, which are relativistic, and then we have photons, which are relativistic. But they actually, neutrinos decouple first, and so they are at different temperature than photons. Okay, so it may happen that they are not all of them at the same temperature. So denote T, the temperature of photons, people like to measure everything in terms of the temperature of the photons. So that's why T of them is important. And then Ti is the temperatures of anything else, of other species. Okay, so then you can write that the total entropy density, you just write it as this were the case, but you put all the information about what the bath is composing of into a prefactor G. So you put this prefactor G and stands for the entropy, and then you put it 2 pi square over 4 pi, 45, and then T cube. S is as if we had only photons, but then this G star of S is some number which contains the information about all the other species. And so G star of S is just sum over bosons. Gi Ti over T cube, and then factor 7 over 8, fermions, and Gi Ti over T cube. Okay, where this Gi is really how many degrees of freedom is hiding in each boson or fermion. So if you have scalar field, a Gi is just 1. If you have electron, Gi is 2. So it's the number of spins, if you want. Okay? So this is all trivial, but it's useful to write it down. So the same thing you can write for the energy density. And now I'm giving you the answer for your homework. So this is what you should find. E to the 4. So that's the prefactor which you should find in your homework. And the same thing, now the G star will be the same thing, but now to the power 4. So bosons, Gi, Ti over T 4, and then plus 7 over 8, fermions, Gi, Ti over T 4. Okay. Now, of course, if the temperatures are the same, if Ti is for all the components, if Ti is equal to T, then this G star of S is the same as for the density G star. But if they are different, they are different. Okay. Okay. And so, yeah, you will play with this in your tutorial to calculate something interesting. So you may be looking forward to this. Everybody's looking forward to this. Okay. So that's what happens with the entropy. So now let me return back to this thermodynamics hating these massive particles. And so really what is important is that there are some departures from equilibrium. so that we can see some massive particles in our universe. So decoupling. And result. So it is the departure from equilibrium that makes our lives interesting. So we know that the thermal equilibrium is valid only if the reaction rate is much, much bigger than the Hubble rate H. Okay? So now it may happen that at some point for some particle the reaction rate actually becomes smaller than that. So if gamma I is now smaller than H, then you say that the species I decouples from the rest of your thermal bus, and this will lead to the free result, which means that the number of the corresponding species actually will be conserved after that. It's not decreasing, the number density is not decreasing exponentially anymore, but rather the number of species of those particles remains constant. So the density goes like 8 cubed, 1 over 8 cubed. Okay? So let me be very specific and let me do an example. And so this leads to free result. So let me be very, very specific. So you can think about a model for cold dark matter. Let's say that the dark matter is described by some unknown particle chi. And so assume that this particle up to some temperature is in thermal equilibrium with the rest of the bus, with the photons and with everything else. And this is of course true if the particle is relativistic. But once the particle stops to be relativistic, so below m chi, so if the temperature is smaller than the mass of that particle, then chi no longer relativistic, and that means that it will be exponentially real. X on n. Okay, so really, if it remains in equilibrium, then it starts exponentially decreasing the number of these particles. So now let's make an assumption, which is maybe not so stupid. So assume that the only way to produce this particle is, well, that these particles can sort of pop up from your vacuum by, let's say, you know, I have some photons and so these collide and they can create the particles. But let's also assume that once, you know, the equilibrium is no longer true, then this process goes only one way. In other words, you can only annihilate particles chi with chi bar with 2 gamma. So to destroy chi, it's only process chi plus chi bar goes to 2 gamma. So in equilibrium it goes both ways, but now because so now it goes only this way. And so however, because the number of these chi particles in the non-relativistic regime is now exponentially decayed, it may happen that actually this particle is looking for his antipartner to annihilate this, but it cannot find it, right? Because these are all exponentially suppressed. No, okay, so when gamma is approximately direction rate of this reaction is you know h or approximately h, it can be you know when it's a factor times h, chi are so rare that cannot find their partner to annihilate. Okay, and if they cannot find their partner to annihilate this, this reaction of course completely stops. But if this reaction completely stops, the number of chi's and the number of chi bars, if you want, is conserved. Okay, so after that, the number of chi's is conserved. So n chi is constant, which means that the density of chi, goes like 1 over a cube. So as the universe expands, the density goes like 1 over a cube. Okay, so now is this beautiful picture which I want to show you. Is, you know, this is what really typically see, what you typically see for processes like this. So on one axis, let me put the particle density of chi divided by t cube. And on the other axis, let me put m chi over the temperature. So now, until we are 1, so OK, so it's 1 here, there's 10 here, and there's 100. So as the temperature decreases, so from left, right, the temperature decreases, of course, m chi is constant. So now, up to here, I have m, but the temperatures are much, much higher than m. That means we have a relativistic regime. And in the relativistic regime, we know that the number of particles behaves as t cube. So m chi over t cube is just a constant. Okay, so here, we have something which is approximately a constant. And that's the relativistic regime. And then, as you are getting to non-relativistic regime, suddenly you would expect this exponential decay of things. You would expect that this would be e to minus m chi over t, so exponential decay, if you stayed in equilibrium, and so there wouldn't be any particles m chi. However, when gamma approximately equals to h, so this reaction actually stops, and we are not in equilibrium anymore. And so there is a departure from equilibrium, and you go again to a constant thing. So m chi looks like 1 over a cube. So this is so okay. So now this is called freeze out. And this is the relic particle density. So the only, it again goes like a constant here. So if it were in equilibrium, you would have 0. But you don't have equilibrium because they cannot find each other. And that's why it will remain constant here. Okay. So the only possibility how we observe something non-trivial, how we observe some relic particles, is that there is a departure from equilibrium at some point. Is that that simple, right? So, but it's also very powerful and very nice. Other questions to this? Okay, so let me just make three remarks on chemical potentials. There is a huge chapter in Mukanov's book, if you want to read more about chemical potentials, on chemical potentials. So for most of the problems, you can sort of neglect the chemical potentials. And so as we did, for example, in this relativistic case, we neglected completely the chemical potential. But sometimes they're actually useful to consider. And of course, in that formula for your thermodynamic distribution, so the energy is a function of temperature, but so is the chemical potential. Right? So the chemical potential, in principle, can depend on temperature. And so as the universe expands, then the chemical potential actually changes for these things. Okay? And so this is mostly useful for exact treatment, which we are not doing here. So if you are doing this Boltzmann approach, then you really need to consider what is the precise value of the chemical potential and what you have to do. But we are not doing it here, so I'll just make three remarks. So you know that in QFT, particles can be created. Particles pop out of vacuum. So unless there is some reason why the particle number should be conserved, so unless there is a conservation law, which would prevent my particle changing, then we have that the chemical potential is actually zero. So this is the case, for example, for photons. So photons mu of gamma is equal to zero because we know that it doesn't cost any energy to create photons out of vacuum, and so their particle number is not conserved, and they can pop out freely. And so, if you think about first law, CD is plus mu vn, so it doesn't cost any energy if mu. So to change the particle number n doesn't cost any energy, so I have to have mu equal to zero. Okay? So mu of gamma always zero. So second remark is that if you have an equilibrium process, so A plus B goes to C plus D, and of course the process goes both ways if you are in equilibrium, then what you can show is that the chemical potentials of the corresponding things must be equal. So in particular, for example, if you have an annihilation of electron with positron, into your photons, then because mu on the of the right hand side is equal to zero, mu of the left hand side, the sum of the two have to be equal to zero. So we have that mu of electron is minus mu of positron. Okay. And my final remark on this, and as I said, if you want to get to know more, read Mukanov's book. There is a whole chapter devoted to chemical potentials, and it's quite non-trivial. Okay, so now mu in general is a function of temperature. As the universe expands, mu changes. And so to derive this dependence on temperature is highly non-trivial. But there are some cases where you can do that. And so to derive this, if you are in a very special example, is that you can use, so this is a general statement, the number of conservation laws laws, which preserve, you know, various particle numbers, is equal to the number of non-trivial chemical potentials. It's number of independent chemical potentials. So let me do this very explicitly. So you know, for example, in particle physics, you have conservation of Lepton's number. So Eg conservation of Lepton number. And so the Lepton number, so this is I goes from electron, muon, and tau. So you have delta and I, that is the difference between the electrons and anti-electrons, and delta of the corresponding neutrinos. And you can show that divided by the entropy density, it must be equal to constant. That is I is an electron, muon, tau. Okay. So this thing is actually conserved. Okay. However, what you can show is that this delta n i, for example, electron, is just number of electrons minus number of anti-electrons. And I think in your homework, again, it is given as an optional problem. So, you know, don't worry about it if you cannot solve it. I'll give you a hint, it's solved in Dodelson. So if you want to know the solution, I think it's solved there. But anyway, so the number of electrons minus the number of positrons, and it's given by T cube, and then mu of electron, and divided by T. Okay, so this is, I think, one of your homework problems. Okay, so now if I plug it there, I know that the entropy goes like T cube, and then this delta n goes like T cube, but it's this mu dependence, mu over T. Okay, that means that if I plug it here, T cube cancels this S, but I have that mu of electron plus mu of the corresponding neutrino, mu, divided by temperature is equal to constant. Okay, from there, and I know that S goes like T cube, so the only thing which must be constant is this thing here. So in other words, you know, for example, that this is a constant, so you know what is the temperature dependence of mu e plus mu of the corresponding neutrino. Okay, and so, you know, calculations like this, they can tell you what is really the temperature dependence of these various chemical potentials. Once you know that, you plug it into your distribution, you do better approximation, and then you can play with these things. Okay.
That difference is also true for muons and tau?
Sorry?
It's also true for muons and...
Yeah, it's also true. So you have three independent laws. One for electrons, one for...
But what should be constant should be like the addition of these three modes, right?
Yeah, but I think, you know, in these... Yeah, I think you can sort of split it into three different...
That's not true that the three independent...
Well, laws. In general, it's not true. But yeah, you know... at which temperatures you are, in some sense, and you can sort of decompose it, I think, into three for a given temperature. So, of course, this will be true only in the vicinity when that is true. Okay, so, yeah, but you're right. So in general, you know, it's more complicated, but, yeah. So, anyway, if you're interested more how this is, you know, precisely done, read Muganov's book. Okay? Very good. So now this was the boring part. So now let's have the fun part. So these are basically all the tools which we need to describe the thermal history of our universe. So let me just briefly describe what are the events which we want to describe. Okay. And then we shall look, you know, into some of these events in more detail. in the following lectures and in tutorials and in your homework. So part B of matter chapter is brief thermal history. And before I start discussing this, let me just mention, it's probably obvious to everybody now by now, that there are various descriptions how you can denote, you know, when what happened. And so one of them, of course, is time. So you can use your coordinate time in the FRW space-time to specify, yeah, this event happened at that given time, this event happened at that given time, and so on. But you can also equally describe that using the conformal time, eta. But because the universe is expanding all the time, and so A, if you want, is a monotonous function, you can also use for your description, you know, how big the universe is. But this also has the same information as, well, what was the temperature of the universe at that time? And that is the same information as what is the redshift of the corresponding radiation coming to you in some sense. Okay, so you can interchange all these various descriptions. And so sometimes people really use, well, they say this event happened when the universe was 1,000 times smaller than it is now. Or sometimes they say, well, it happened when the redshift was 10, or something like that. Okay, so all these can be interchanged, and then you have the wonderful relations between them. So for example, you know that A is proportional to 1 over T, and so on. And it's proportional to 1 over omega, and so on. There is also a miraculous formula, which is valid for radiation era. So radiation era, it's a miraculous formula, which really is used by cosmologists often. So you can measure the temperature, however, in the units of mega electron volts, and it's approximately given by 1 divided by square root of t in seconds. So if you want to know, you know, what was the temperature of the universe, or what were the energies in the universe, let's say at t equal to 1 second after Big Bang, then you know that it was approximately 1 MeV. Okay, and so this is a very useful formula valid in the radiation era. All right, so now let me start discussing this history. And let me start from now. So here will be my axis t, will be in seconds after the Big Bang, or I will use the energies or whatever. So now we are 10 to the 16 seconds after the Big Bang. And we know that what we see around us is galaxies. And so these galaxies were formed by gravitational instabilities. Small inhomogeneities in the energy density. Okay, so now I will not discuss this at all in this course. You will discuss a little bit with Kendrick in the exploration course, I hope, about structure formation, basically. It's interesting, so you can do, again, some estimates, analytical estimates for these things using Newtonian gravity or whatever. But in some sense, again, this is based on heavy numerical calculations. Okay, and so people still do, you know, you can, if you're interested, you can do research on structure formation, and it's a heavy numerical structure formation. That's an interesting, still open question how to do it precisely. Another research topic related to this era, of course, is the origin of dark matter and dark energy. Okay, it's sort of now we observe that many, that much dark matter and that much dark energy. The question is, what is the origin of this? So now, even to this era, there's lots of questions, actually, if you are interested in pursuing cosmology. Of course, this is mostly the lambda-dominated era. Okay, so that's here and now. So now, another interesting event which happened in the universe, in the history, was the CMB release, and that happened 10 to the 12 seconds after the Big Bang. And so what it is, basically, I'll discuss a little bit more in detail, but not much more in detail, is that you have, so the temperature of the universe now is relatively very, very cold. And so what happens is that before, you could go both ways to form the hydrogen. So you could combine the electron with proton and hydrogen and then release some gamma. But at this point, the temperature is so small that the reaction basically goes only one way, and so you form a neutral hydrogen. And all the photons which are released in this reaction actually are sort of free to roam the whole universe, and they don't bond, and they don't, you know, interact with electrons and anything else anymore. Okay, so photons released in this reaction are roam free. After this, and so they haven't really interacted with anything else after this happened, and so you observe them as CMB. And you know that happened at the time. It happened very, very quickly. So, and you know the event is called surface of last scattering. Questions? No. Okay. So now, then to the 11, radiation matter equality. That means that whatever happens here is the matter dominated era. Whatever happens before 10 to the 11 is radiation dominated era. So here, radiation starts. Yeah, and this has some again, the consequence is that CMB happened after, it already happened in the matter dominated era. That has some consequences, interesting. So now we jump a lot, and we go all the way to 3 minutes. So 3 minutes, which is, I think I used that formula for relating seconds to mega electron volts, which is 0.1 mega electron volts. So at this time, you actually fuse the heavy elements in the universe. Called Big Bang nucleosynthesis. And so you form heavy elements like helium, lithium, and so on. So before that, you just had protons and neutrons, if you want, but they were not combined in a nuclear. So you really fuse them into helium only at 3 minutes after the Big Bang. Okay, so now we want 6 seconds, which is 0.5 mega electron volts. There was lots of electrons and lots of positrons before, but they annihilated all of them basically here. And so we have only very, very few electrons left. And so you have one electron per 10 to the 9 photons. I'll just explain this in a minute. So the electrons annihilated at 6 seconds. Before that, also decoupled, the neutrinos decoupled from here. And that happened 1 second, 1 second, which is 1 MeV. Neutrinos decouple from the rest of the relativistic mass, if you want. And so neutrinos, basically, what they are doing at this point is that they are changing neutrons to protons. So you have a reaction where the neutron absorbs neutrino and makes a proton, or the other way around. So now, once these neutrinos decouple, of course, this reaction doesn't go any longer. So that means that the neutrons and protons decouple. Okay, so neutron proton decoupling. So now you know that the neutrons, however, are unstable. Okay, so proton is stable and you know happy; it can live forever, basically. But the neutron cannot. So now at this point, at 1 second, actually, you decouple neutrons from protons. So at this point, there's something like approximately the same number of neutrons as protons. Not really, but after that, neutrons start decaying, whereas the number of protons remains the same. So now you have to capture these neutrons to form the heavy elements. But you have only little time to do that. Because if you wait long enough, all the neutrons will decay and they will not exist anymore, and you will not form heavy elements. Okay? So really, there was a rush to do this from neutron decoupling to go to Big Bang nuclear synthesis. You have only a little bit of time. And so this decay rate of neutrons, so decay time for neutron is something like 10 minutes or something like that. You will discuss that tomorrow. So really, you know, if you waited 10 minutes, there wouldn't be any neutrons left. So you can wait only approximately 3 minutes so that you have the right number of neutrons to form the right number of observed helium in the universe. Okay, so this is very, very important time here. Okay, and we will discuss that. So now, nobody knows if or when the dark matter throws out. Or actually, if there is any dark matter. 10 to minus 5 seconds, which is 150 MeV. You have the QCD phase transition. Okay. So very well understood physics. Before that, you have the electroweak phase transition. So now your vector bosons become massive. Again, very well understood physics, and all, you know, accessible in your accelerators on the Earth. So, you know, up to these energies, you know, everything is, you know, well, very well established physics. So 10 to minus 10, 10 to minus 10 seconds after the Big Bang, minus 10. Which is 10 tera electron volts. 10 to minus 10 is 100 GeV. 100 GeV. You have electroweak phase transition. Okay. And then up to the energy is 10 to minus 14 seconds, or 10 electron volts, you can still do, you know, this is still radiation, of course, phase, but this is accessible still by LHC. Okay. Still accessible. Still well established physics. Accessible. LHC. And so this is basically based on standard model physics. Okay, so now before that, there is some speculation what might have happened, but certainly what had to happen is the baryogenesis the big question here, so you had to create, let's say, protons and antiprotons. And the question is, of course, these protons and antiprotons at some point annihilated together. And it turns out that actually not all of them annihilated, but we still have some protons left in our universe. And the ratio, there is this baryon asymmetry. And this is the origin of why we have so many photons in the universe. So if you have the density of the baryons divided by density of the photons is approximately 10 to minus 9. Okay, so you know, not all the protons with antiprotons annihilated, but there was one more proton in 10 to the 9 protons, which was more than antiproton. And that's why we have some protons left. And the question is, you know, why exactly we have one, so we have 10 to the 9 plus 1 protons and only 10 to the 9 antiprotons. And the question is, you know, what is the origin of this asymmetry? And nobody knows, and it's an interesting question. There are some, you know, general frameworks why this must be true, but nobody knows this thing here. Okay, so that's a puzzle, if you want. Another puzzle is you could, in principle, create topological defects from some phase transitions in the early universe. And in particular, you could create cosmic strings, or you could create domain walls. And you have learned about these in your gravitational physics course, so I don't need to go into that. But at this point, there is no observational evidence that any of these actually do exist in our universe. So it's an interesting possibility, theoretical possibility, of creating these objects, but it's not, there's no evidence. And finally, there is an inflation which, you know, would take place in these times. And so we will discuss that in detail. And then, of course, 10 to minus 30. 43 seconds. We are at the Planck scale. And so here you would have to use non-perturbative quantum gravity, and nobody knows what it is. But here we are happy and we have the Big Bang. Okay? So this is it's not really brief history of the universe, but it's the history briefly, okay, here. And then we will discuss some of these things in more detail in the following lectures. So tomorrow you'll start Big Bang nuclear synthesis, and it's something which is really, really beautiful and can be done in three lines to actually calculate the right ratio if you fiddle the constants and things properly. Okay, so that will be tomorrow. Questions?
What do you mean by T gamma is greater than T neutrino?
Ah, very good. So I didn't mention that. So what happens is that because the neutrinos decouple first, okay? So in some sense, as something is decoupling, it is transferring its energy to the rest of the relativistic path. So you cannot, when you usually decouple something, it transfers the energy to the rest of the path. So as the neutrinos actually decoupled, they heated up the remaining path, and that's why photons have, you know, bigger temperature at this point than neutrinos. It's a very interesting prediction of Big Bang theory that really we should also not be observing on the cosmic microwave background for photons, but we should have the similar background for neutrinos. But, however, the temperature for neutrinos is smaller than 2.7. And moreover, neutrinos are very, very difficult to capture. So nobody really, you know, observed this precise, but it's a precise prediction what the temperature of neutrinos should be at this point. Yeah, sorry, I didn't mention that. Thanks. Okay, see you tomorrow.